Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing. Let's see. Today is Tuesday, May the 21st, isn't it? At the home here of Mr. James T. Graham. Talk a little bit about bottom. Mr. Graham, are you a native of Frankfort?
I'm a native of Frankfort. I was born and raised right here. 64 years old, almost 65.
Where were you born in Frankfort?
I was born at the next door to the house that I lived in. I lived at 609. I was born at 609 Washington Street.
Okay, where would that have been?
That's between Hill Street and Miro.
Ah, okay.
Well,
when you remember your early years there at Washington Street, tell me a little bit about the house you grew up in, your family.
Well, we rented from a fellow called Mr. Krauts, and in later years he gave us an opportunity to buy the house. It was just a small three-room house. It was my father, my mother, and I had a brother, named Paul. And that was, the fifth house from the corner of Miro Street.
So you were born there in 27?
1926.
26, okay.
1926, June the 24th, 1926.
Was the house just a little wooden frame?
Just a little wooden frame house.
Did y'all have electric or plumbing?
Well,
or?
We got electric later, and we got plumbing later. You know, actually, when we started out, we had lamps. We used to have that was one of our early jobs, was cleaning out these lamps with the newspaper.
Like kerosene?
Kerosene.
Yeah.
Lamps, yeah. And that was, I guess, probably. And it was almost the 40s before we got the electricity.
When you remember those early years, was your daddy working? Or?
Yeah, my mother was a seamstress. She made our own clothes, I mean, that's up until we were about maybe about 14, 15 years old.
So you could work
and,
in the home?
Yeah, she worked in the home, and she worked when the Catherine shop was open. She, I think the first, second week it was open, Mrs. Catherine Roberts hired her as the seamstress, and she stayed there for 30-some years.
Good grief. Yeah. What was her name?
Her name was Ann Graham.
Ann Graham.
And, my father, he was kind of like a hustler, I guess you'd have to call that. And he'd go from job to job. He worked with Hillenmeyer for a while. You know, when
the nurseries.
The nurseries when they sided the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he worked doing that, and otherwise. And then he was a bartender for Mike Deacon. He worked at in the whiskey store for Mike Deacon.
I've heard of Mike Deacon's. Can you describe it to me, where it was and what it looked like?
Mike Deacon's had a place, a whiskey store right at the, on the other side of Clinton Street going toward Broadway. And, at that time it was the only whiskey store. George Taylor bought all of Mike Deacon's out even before he died. And, but that was the whiskey store moved three different places. They had two little whiskey stores there when George Taylor had it. He had one on the left-hand side in between Broadway, and he had one on the right-hand side of Washington Street.
Where Washington ran into Broadway? When was your dad working down there?
Well, he worked there when he was actually working there when he had a stroke.
Yeah.
In the 60s, and That was, you know, before the flood, because he died in 66. But this was all during the time of the, when they were going through the very stage of urban renewal.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, the folk down there, was it mainly black, or were there whites and blacks living together?
It was blacks and whites. On the corner where I lived, between then we had one white family, which was the Marshalls, and which we were just like sisters and brothers, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, if food was a lot of light, you just put a little more water in the beans and everybody, you know, that was the type thing, the kind of relationships that we had. And of course, I had several on Wilkson Street and Hill Street in certain sections. There was three or four families, that was mixed there, that had black and white, all on the far side of Hill Street, which some of them, we had some in the middle of Clinton Street, not Clinton, but, well, on the far side of Clinton. On one side, it was about five families, and on the other side, it was about two families of whites. But that was the way it was, from Washington Street to Wilkson Street. Then on the other end, on Wilkson Street proper, behind Mayo Underwood, all the way up to the edge of Hill Street. See, there was a little mixture of...
Miss Follis and her people.
Miss Follis, mostly John Follis and some of his... he lived right on the corner there of Hill and Wilkson Street. And across from that was Miss Ruby Jackson, which was black. And because it was, like I say, there was always the Follises, Bixie, and all of them. I can remember we had one that ran for a representative, and of course that...
Carlos.
Yeah. You know that about him.
Well, Bixie, I talked to Vivian. You remember Vivian?
Yeah.
And those Follises were wild boys.
Wild. Old man was something else. He had a certain rule that everybody followed. That was one of the things that...
What do you mean when you say a certain rule?
Well, it's just like I say, he treated everybody, as long as you had respect, he respected you, and he didn't let anybody mistreat you, you know what I mean, as far as kids were concerned. A lot of times, you know, like I say, they would run, you had little jobs, I've seen the thing, but I used to, a lot of times I made more money emptying slop jars, believe it or not.
Good grief.
Then your father would make working, you know.
Well, you're working for Follis emptying slop jars?
There was some of the other people that was a lady called Hyda Howard. I worked for Frog Woods at the grocery, but I delivered a lot of groceries to this lady called Hyda Howard.
I've heard that her reputation might...
Like, yeah, a little devious.
It's, yeah, Miss Howard. As a matter of fact, didn't she and Mr. Follis have a relationship?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, they did. She was...
Where was Frog Woods' place?
Frog Woods was at the corner of Miro and Washington Street. And Lonzo Lewis was on the other corner of Wilkerson and Miro. And then on the other corner of going into the way St. Clair was Triplett's Grocery.
Triplett's Grocery.
Yeah.
What was Alonzo Lewis's place a grocery too?
It was a grocery too. All three of those were grocery stores. That most of the blacks, between them and Sullivan, the two Sullivans, one of the Sullivan stores was across from John Follis. That was a little alley that ran in between there, just a little half a street. And that was Nell Sullivan that ran that one.
Nell
Sullivan was her name. She ran that particular store. And like I say, these five stores more or less catered to the black.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where most of where you got your groceries, either on the ticket
They'd let you run a tab?
They let you run a tab. All of them were very nice, most of the people there.
Were those black owned and operated?
No, they were all white owned and operated. But all of them had black delivery boys, sometimes some of them even had black clerks.
So it was a place you could get a job.
Right. It was one of those places because that was a lot of money in there, I guess, to make $6 a week.
Your rent was probably $3 a week, five.
At that time, the house that we lived, it was about $20 a month.
Okay.
And then it went up to about $30-some a month. Of course, all of this was during the childhood days. And then,
1930s, you said?
30s. And then the 30s and the early 40s.
Do you remember the 37 flood?
Very much so.
What happened
to you? The 37 flood, I rode in a boat with my father over the top of my house. Over the top of the house that I lived in, 611 Washington Street. The house next to that was a two-story house, and the boat was up to the window in the second story. I can remember that very well.
Did y'all go back in after the water went down?
After the water went down, we went in and cleaned. We washed and soaked and did all this trying to get the, finally got out. We went back every time other than the 62 flood. It's the only time we didn't go back.
Why'd you go back?
All
the trouble?
Well, at that time, we had bought the house. Bought that house. And, not in 37. We bought the house in 40-something. But we went back. That's when we added, it was a blessing in a way because that's when we put the electricity in and we built, we took the porch and built a...
You mean after 37?
Yeah, we built this toilet on where the porch was.
One of those frost-free outdoor toilets?
Yeah, this was one of those... We did a modern tub and everything in there at that particular time. It was in the 40s. It was in the 40s.
Well, let me ask you about your school days.
Right.
Where did you go to Mayo Underwood?
I went to Mayo Underwood. I started out in kindergarten. Mayo Underwood had been built. It opened up the year that I could go to kindergarten.
About 32, maybe.
Yeah, right. That's it. I was 60. Well, they let me go. My birthday was in June, and they let me start actually in the kindergarten. I think it was 5 years old. So, I was in the first kindergarten class under Miss Johnson. I never will forget that. And then, I stayed in school until I went into the war. I left in the 10th grade and went to service. And then I came back in 46 and went back to finish high school.
What outfit did you join up with?
I went to in the Navy. I was in the, I went to Great Lakes in the Navy. And then the Navy transferred me to the Seabees. I went to the 34th NCBs, and I went to Fort Wyoming, California. And from Fort Wyoming, California, strictly right on to Okinawa.
Oh, man. Did you make it in time for the big...
Well, we got in there at the end. It was winding down, but I got all the action I wanted.
You wanted to see.
Actually, when the day that we left from Okinawa, there was several Japanese surrendered that had been, didn't know that the war was over.
Well, you must have only been 16 or 17 years old.
I was 18 years 18. Old. I was 19. I stayed overseas until I was 20. I was 20. I got back here on 19th of 46, and I turned 20 on the 24th.
Well, some of the vets I've talked to left Frankfort and went north for jobs, but you stayed. Yeah, why?
I left at one time in 1951. I left and went to Dayton, and my wife never wanted to come. I mean, that was because after we got married, and we got married in 48, and had two kids right quick, and I decided to go to Dayton. I worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for 2 years, and we just never could get. I guess she could have come up there with a better job than I could, because one of our high school friends was in a position personnel type thing, but we just kept dickering about it. Because, as I say, it was tough for me to come back. Sometimes I wouldn't only be off on 24 hours, and I'd run it at only one day a week. You know, I was on security at Wright-Patterson. So we were only off one day a week.
Not enough to even come down and visit your families.
I say, when I'd come down, you know, I'd have to turn and just look, come in and go right back, you know.
When did you come on back to Frankfort?
I came back, I finally got a transfer. Well, I was working on a transfer to go to work at Narcotic Farm at Lexington. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, I'd gone sleep on the job. So I was in a little trouble there. So rather than to, get dismissed, I kind of got ready. Like you say, it was one of those times I'd gone back to work, come down here, and try to go back and go to work, right?
You hadn't slept for 24 hours, probably.
And it just finally got to me.
Well, when you came back here, where did you come back to?
I went to work at the state. I went to work at the state. That was in I worked for the state for the Division of Publicity.
Oh yeah.
At the time it was all under conservation at the time under Henry Ward. And I worked at I had a little experience of really before that I'd worked for the Department of Education for 2 years, and I was one of the first that of any kind that was taught the multi-lift machine. So I had printing, and I had this guy that was selling these machines, and in other words, I'd go around and demonstrate them to the other part of the state. I think we sold them probably in that couple of years. Believe it or not, I'd get $25 for demonstrating the machines, and they get, I think, and maybe in a period of 7-8 months, they sold maybe 20 of those things. That was what they call the dresser graphs at that time.
Were you living down in the bottom when you came back?
I was living in the bottom. I still was living in the bottom. I lived at 308 Blanton Street after, because I'd married. I was running from Bob Dry, Mrs. Dry, that lived on the corner of Ann and Clinton Street at the corner there.
Oh, okay.
Because now he had a girl, that husband had a grocery that was on the corner. Brian had bought that grocery out. That was on the lower end. That was center of Blaine Street, we called it, and St. Clair.
Yeah, okay. What was the name of the grocery?
It was Brian's Grocery Brian's Den, but it was Bob Dry's first. They had always, Mrs. Dry and all of them were Bob, and even Sam worked in that old grocery there at the corner. And they had this house right on Blaine Street, and that's what they rented, that little four-room house. Now that house had the toilet that if you got up of you heard of the tank toilets that they had in.
No, how did it
even
work?
It had it in, even inside the house. That was what that's where that was the setup there. It was a you sat on the stool and then when you got up it placed itself.
So, yeah. Yeah. Well, I heard it was sort of a rare thing to have indoor plumbing.
Well, we just had at that time in that particular stretch. I'd say that probably it was only maybe five houses that had any type of plumbing in them in that area. Most of them still had a lot of outdoor plumbing.
Did the people that lived down there refer to the area as Bottom or Craw, or would that have been considered derogatory?
Well, actually you had two, the Craw and the Bottom. Well, one in the same in a sense that some streets, you know, that some sections of the streets wouldn't have been called the Craw. But, you know, usually any people referring, they referred to the whole thing as the Bottom.
Well, what sections were Craw?
Actually, the one street was the street from Broadway to Miro.
Okay.
Was actually called the Bottom. Really, it didn't even go all the way down to the end of Miro Street. They would always just classify that section between about a half a block down to Madison Street and about halfway down to where those houses I was showing you there.
Mm-hmm.
That was at the half of this block here, right at this street going down Clinton, would be, and these are the houses right there in that area. That's a little place was running across that ran up to the trestle. There's a little alley there that ran from Clinton Street to Broadway. And that's what they classified. All that was classified as the Bottom.
Okay.
That was the Bottom.
Were people who lived in the Bottom, was it sort of a stable neighborhood, or were there people coming and going all the time?
Well, you know, a lot of the whole thing was that the people in the Bottom that actually lived in the Bottom, they wouldn't cause any trouble. It was the people that came and visiting that usually created all the problems. Because, I mean, it was a good rapport. You had a good sense of, as I say, people cared about each other. You know, I mean, if it's if a family was in need, these people, either what do we call the hustlers and the gamblers, they'd get a pot together, you know, and they just
help
somebody
out.
That would just take the money, no strings attached, and it helped anybody out. I mean, if it was sickness or death or whatever, you know.
So trouble came in from the
outside, really. You know,
what brought those people in from the outside?
Well, it was fascinating. You know, you had call girls, the house of ill repute, as you said. You had these two or three houses there that was, you know.
Where were they, on Center, or?
They were really off of, you had one, you had two, probably right in the heart of Bottom. It was on Clinton Street. You had a fellow that was like some of them that you had to bring your own, you had to go to these joints and pick up a lady there. This was what they would do, and they'd go down and this guy would run like a little, he'd furnish rooms, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had they had the places where the girls was already there, you know. And that was the type thing that just was. And the bad part about it was that I always see the rich people would come in and do the little dirt, the girling.
Yes.
And they were gone and that was over, you know. I mean, some of the finest families in Frankfurt, well, you see them now and see them then, you know.
Imagine that makes them a little, they're probably the same ones that condemn the people who live down in the bottom.
Exactly right. And it's the same way that we had the problem with people in South Frankfurt and what we call the hill. See, they would come down and raise all the sand in the Bottom and then they'd go home. See, and leave, you know. I mean,
where was the hill?
The hill was the campus. I mean, it was the people that lived on East Maine, and because you had some people that had some fine homes. You had some of your, you know, your craft people, the black craft, the bricklayers and stone basins that lived, and now they could, you know, more or less had money every day, you know. At that time, that trade was good, you know. And then you had some of your business people that, you know, they'd come down and raise a whole lot of sand, and then they gone, you know.
So, as far as the violence, it was more or less confined to maybe people getting intoxicated
or joints, exactly, or something. That was the type of thing that would happen. And as I just said, you had three churches were, your Corinthian church was on the corner, Miro Street there, which was a very big church, and I mean it had a very good following, you know. And as I say, in this particular area, you had maybe five teachers that lived in it, and that, like I say, they lived in the bottom, they were not basically affected by the bottom, you know.
What were the names? Do you remember the teachers' names? I'm curious.
Well, you have Miss Alice Simpson, Miss Patty Simpson. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, they lived in this house right here, right next to Sullivan's
Grocery.
There's a house that set back, and then they lived in it. You can see the big house right there. Mm-hmm. That was that big house.
Alice the principal at
Maine? Alice at one time was she taught at Rosenwald.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. Then you had Miss Alice Samuels, who lived right two doors from the crawl itself. I mean, she lived, there was the restaurant, which was the Cozy Corner.
Where's Cozy Corner? It's on the corner.
Kind of corner from the American Legion, the big building you're talking about.
Clinton and Washington. Okay.
All right, there was another house, a small house in between that, and they lived in the third house going back toward Hill Street on Washington Street. Yeah. Okay. They lived there because she, her mother, and the whole family lived in that particular house, which was one of the best kept probably house on that street in that section.
Let me say this to you. I've heard people refer to that area, the bottom area, as a slum.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Is that accurate?
Well, it's accurate to a certain extent, because if you took the whole picture, I mean, you took the number of houses that were run down, but you had some people that had a little pride that they would do paint, you know, but that was the only thing. You might have a house that was well kept, and then the house next to that would be a run down. I mean, it just dilapidated, totally dilapidated. See, you had a man, we call the three men that owned most of the property down there was Dooley Moss. Dooley Moss, which was a jackleg lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot about Dooley.
He's the man that broke my grandfather's will. This is a man that broke my grandfather's will. My grandfather owned where Montrose Park is right now.
Good grief. Own that whole area?
He owned that area. They made that area. They kept dumping dirt until they made that area.
Ah.
But that was there was two houses there in the front. His brother lived in one of them. He lived on Hill Street. He had that property.
What did Doolin do? Did he break?
He broke the wheel. Mr. Pat Sullivan was the administrator for this wheel. I don't know how my grandfather came into this money. How he would come up with this particular things, but he evidently was a pretty smart businessman of some type. I don't know how, but he would, you know, at least he bought, they wound up with a lot of property in town.
What was your grandfather's name?
His name was Thomas Graham.
Thomas Graham.
Graham.
on his ground.
So Moss broke the will and the property went
to someone? My grandmother by marriage was, they could pay for divorce in installment plans. Well, when he died, they did not, she hadn't finished paying and he had left his, he had two sons, my father and another, my Morgan Graham, and he left them a dollar apiece, and left his total estate to my brother and I. When we become 21, that we would inherit this. So a lot of time we needed school clothes, we needed things like that, so they would dish out a certain amount of money.
Executor.
Right. So when we did get 21, after I got out of service, we got 21. It was very little money left. But
what were the two other men that owned a lot of property in Bottom? You said there was three.
Well, the other fellow, it was, they were called the Rufus. They had the houses, the big houses up on the corner of, they started at the corner of Broadway and on this side of the railroad track.
Mm-hmm.
Broadway and Washington. And it ran all the way down. They had about four apartment houses going toward Wilson Street. Then they had all of these other houses in front of the school.
Hmm.
They had.
That's a name I hadn't heard before, Rufus. That's the last name, surname.
That's the name, Rufus.
Is any of them still in town?
No, they've been dead. They died. One, whatever the, these were all white. They were, because if you wanted the black landowners, of course, across the school you had Ernest Woolridge. Okay.
John Buckner.
And the same thing happened there. You know, like all of these houses, like I say, you know, I don't know if anybody told you, but the sign that used to have, that they had in the courthouse where that the, he bought that sign, and that's what he refurbished a bunch of his houses with, was that
sign?
That sign that had all the veterans' names from Franklin County on it. I mean,
John Buckner.
He bought that sign, and that's what they used that lumber. He'd buy old houses and they'd tear them down and they'd.
Did these men keep up their property, or is that why?
Well, they some of them tried.
Mm-hmm.
Earl Tracy had quite a bit. And of course, like I say, some of them didn't. The thing that teed me off about the whole nine yards was that the people that were trying to maintain and doing the, a lot of people had put quite a bit of hard-earned money into the houses when it became final. Proud, you know, this was a long-going thing that, like Mrs. Holmes had owned a house. I could name you, I'd say maybe 25 people that had owned that
finally
house.
Paid off the
and
house.
Finally paid off the homes. And because they came in with a deal, they wanted everybody to put up $200, even husbands and wives, and to try to save. It's like her mother, she had owned two houses. She had already owned two houses that she lived in, and another house that she was renting. And as they say, if you didn't sell, those houses mysteriously got burnt.
Well, that's what your wife told me.
They would get burnt. They were torched. And the fire department would be right there watching them. You know, they'd see that they burned all the way down, you know. The firemen would be on the scene.
If you were a property owner and holding out for a better price,
they also knew how much insurance you had. So when you paid, whatever the insurance company paid you for the fines, that was deducted out of
the proceeds of the sale,
and which meant that they were always less.
You said something that caught my attention. Yeah. You said they wanted everybody to contribute $200 a piece to save. What was the deal there? I don't understand.
Well, they had these lawyers that came from Washington, D.C. that were going to try to fight them. And they
who got the lawyers?
Well, I guess some of the leadership in town, they called themselves, was going to try to get these lawyers. They never came back. There was never anything done about that.
Was that so, J.S. Carroll and Mr. Nippenberg, right, Julius Nippenberg? Nippenberg never came back. I read accounts in the newspaper where they made these statements, how they're going to fight for the rights.
Right, exactly right. They never showed back up. It was like this. I'd say my grandmother, or my step grandmother, and even her husband, Miss Mary C. Holmes. I could name you 20 people easily.
Did they contribute $200
a
piece?
Mm-hmm. They got, you know, they were some people that borrow that money, you know, to.
So they had paid these attorneys all this money. Was a lawsuit ever filed to try?
Nobody ever knew how to really. I don't know. See, nobody wanted to take credit for even contacting them. How they contacted these other people to do it, but I mean, it was that's what happened.
You are the first person who's ever been able to tell me anything about that.
I'll tell you,
because nobody, I guess, wants to be associated with it for some reason.
Well, I'm telling you, because at the time, I mean, because I guess I was a rebel. I was a total rebel, because I thought I could see that this was a sham. All of this was a sham. The whole thing was it irked me so much. And I, as I say, see, I mean, during this time, I know the hardship that some of the people that had gone through, you know. And I said, well, you know, it's like these promises that they said. Well, I remember I went to that one meeting that they promised that you'll be able. They showed the big plaque that you'll be able to buy back at probably what we're going to give you for the property and these will be houses, and this will be this.
Who was making those kind of promises to you? Do you remember?
Actually, the head at that time was the head of Urban Renewal right here. Right? Charles Parrish.
I tried to get him there.
Perry.
Charles R. Perry.
Perry was a man that he hoodwinked the whole society of people.
What was the story on him? Do you know how he got hooked up with Urban Renewal? Or
I don't know how he did it. I don't know when he just came out of the woodwork. And of course, like I say, with promises, it was, and then I'm making a parable, and I said, you know, it was just like this. I've made several references to this in the later years about it. I said, well, it's just like they've got us off of that slave ship with a piece of red flannel and a bone. You know, but he got the people's confidence. You know, he came, he would be down there every day, you know, tell them about what, and this is going to be so much better, you're going to be able to relocate and you're going to do this. Fortunately, in a sense, we were one of the lucky ones.
How so?
We were lucky for some reason that we left. We went to a better house, and that when we moved across from the post office, we got that, you know, got that house from that I can't think of it. Oh, Cohorn. We were lucky enough, because like I say, we had four people, really five people working, and so we could. We could pool our resources, and we were able to buy that house.
Well, did you all get what you considered a fair price on your home?
Not. We couldn't. We really, you know, I mean, I say we didn't have any option, but I mean, the house was well kept, and it had maintained and painted and everything of this type, it was just, you know, what we expanded on, what we built. on the back and everything. It was, but we had no choice. Mm-hmm. You know, it was one of those things where that everybody else had sold all around us. We didn't. We just sat, and then it was like we knew too that if we didn't sell, it'd be torched. Yeah. You know.
You're the first person that's told me about the fires. That's the first time. Do you remember how you found out about the project?
Well, when they, yeah, we found out about the project at a meeting. There was another meeting that, I think that was Sutherland. That, when they
Fred Sutherland? Fred
Sutherland, yeah. When they talked about building this thing up here. And of course everybody was saying, well, now, in other words, now they're going to do us like the Indians. They're going to put us on a reservation, you know.
So, Sutherland Terrace is a reservation.
It was. We stop and think about it. One police car can stop any vehicle going through there. You know, that was it was a thing. You stop and think it. You could walk, maybe walk out, but you couldn't. You drive. Couldn't drive out.
You think it's sort of they could keep better control
of it. It was exactly. It was one of those type things, and this was all in the thinking of that. You know, so it's true.
Do you remember what you felt when you first found out about it?
Yeah, of course, as I say, we had already made arrangements for this, to buy this other house, and I said, well, this is going to be another settlement that'll be, you know, where that, in all probability, it will turn right back into another slum.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to have a certain cross of sections of what's come to satisfy what it called for. And it's like I say, when all the rest of them, they kept building them up, it was, you could see the same thing was going to happen. I know that Miss Nellie Harris, she had been displaced one time. She lived right next to us and had a nice house, a nice stone house. And she moved to Hill Street, which she went into a tremendous amount of debt there. But the ladies that she was working for, she worked for the Carruthers, two old ladies, old lady maids, and one of them worked in the education department with me and the other sister, they were helping her, you know, mm-hmm. to they wanted to see, she'd worked with them all her life, so they wanted to make sure that she had a home, and they supplemented, that's the only reason she would buy that. Then, of course, here comes the other tragic, and it displaced her.
That's what I understood. Yeah. The original project was not to affect Hill Street.
Right, really.
And they expanded it.
Expanded it, you know, and then went on to Rosewood and down the other things. But all of these things is, like I said, the plan, they kept talking about a 20-year plan or whatever the original idea was, that they were going to build all of these things, but they were all going to be, that where that you could still have gone back into the slum area and built a house if you were able to do it, mm-hmm. which that never materialized because it was never made a building.
No.
You look at the planning, the way all the flood that had happened, mm-hmm. has the Capitol Plaza ever flooded since then?
No.
Why couldn't you have done this, you know, years ago? I mean, it made you say, well, improve your property. It's just like, This street here was blank, the lower, the high end of blank. You had on that corner the Brookses, was the old man Brooks was a stonemason at the end of Ann Street.
Yeah.
Right where the, you know, where the cave is now. That was a magnificent stone building house. The lady next to that was my sister-in-law owned that house. They had done a tremendous amount of work. The next house to that was the only shabby house on the street. Mm-hmm. Because everybody on that street had and all of them owned it, all of them owned that property, each one of them. My mother-in-law had a very nice two-story house there. That's where they burned it down. And then I had to say the little house there next to that was, it was a little shabby. But it still was, you know, it had been made, it had been painted, everything. And all the way to the end of the corner, was to the end of, which was the end of St. Clair.
Well, why did they expand the project area? I don't understand.
Well,
do you know?
I don't know. It's like I say, they had, they would find out, like I say, I don't think they ever realized how many people that they had displaced. And of course, it made families break up that maybe had two families in the one house. Sometimes three families.
Where did the families go when they got this? Did they have any place to relocate?
Most of them didn't have any place to. A lot of them, I mean, they were working, doing housework, things of this type. They didn't have the facilities if they were already renting. And at that time, they didn't do what they do now. They displace and pay for you to move and relocate you. You had to go out on your own to find this, to find these places.
So, were families evicted if they were renting?
Sure, right. They were evicted. Some of them tried to stay there. They were either evicted or burned out. It's just that simple. That was when they got down to the, because like I say, when John Buckner, when they sold, well, that probably, in that particular area, I'd say he had seven houses. Mm-hmm. He had one building there that had six different families in it, in that one building. Okay, then on Whitehead, he had another big building, which he had five families in that particular building. Then the little building that he had next to that, and well, I'll say when he sold, that affected 15 families.
They said, or at least I've read, that a lot of people wound up renting from the city or the slums.
Right. People that they left staying in, the houses they left. Yeah. They had these particular houses. Some of those people stayed in there maybe a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah.
And they rented from the city, paid rent to the city.
Exactly. Do you remember Frank Lewis?
Yes, Frank Lewis, definitely.
He's still alive and with us.
Did you? Well, see, Frank Lewis, I worked for Frank Lewis.
Oh, you did?
I worked at Sherman Williams, and then he was there. Frank was at Sherman Williams. Frank Williams and Frank and Jim, what was Jim's name? They ran Sherman Williams Paint Company.
I know Frank was a relocation officer for the slum clearance for a long time.
He came in late.
Yeah.
He came in late. He had more dealings with the... Gene Hines. Yeah.
Why did they? Do you know why they brought in Perry? Went out in '63, and Gene Hines came in.
Yeah.
Do you know if there was something why Perry left and Hines came in, or anything about it?
I just think probably some of the people got to the place where probably they, I thought they might kill that man. You know, with some of the things that they'd done. Here's what happened. Some of the relatives that had been gone to Detroit, to Chicago, in Ohio, and they come back and saw what was happening, you know, to their relatives. You know, they become kind of balanced.
You
can see some of the, you know, some of this was like air property. Mm-hmm. And that's why you wonder sometimes how they manipulated these deeds or sold it without getting consent from
the heirs.
They had to either condemn it or whatever they did, you know, some of the vehicles that they used to do that. But that was another problems. But as I say, Frank, he came in the late stages of the thing.
With 64 and 5
right,
and all that.
Right.
You say the 62 flood changed everything. What did you mean when you said
that? Well, it's like I say, some people just decided that that this would be good, that they wasn't going back, they wasn't going to go through this again. And some of the, you know, particularly some of the people that that didn't own their property.
Yeah.
See, they said, well, we'll find housing somewhere else. And that's what a lot of them, you know, was thinking in terms of the yield. And some of them were glad to go to the projects, you know, to get out of this area.
Would your family, if you had not had your own home and all, would you have considered the public housing?
I would never have considered public housing.
To my knowledge, the only public housing that was built back in the bottom, or close to the bottom, was the Riverview.
Yeah.
It was the only housing units that ever went back down in there.
Right. That was
Someone said that that no blacks were involved in the planning of the urban. Do you know of any black resident that was ever involved in the planning?
No, I know of none. They were eliminated, totally eliminated. It was a few. You had a few. I had maybe two that would have. You know, they were seemingly sympathetic, but you never, if you didn't, it wasn't at the meeting of the city council at the time, you would get fogged, mm-hmm. very fogged opinion of what was said sometimes.
Did you go to any city council meetings or?
Yeah, I did. Did
you raise any questions or issues?
No, I was the type, I tried to take them on one-on-one deals. That I would question some of the politicians as to, because they would, they lied to you good.
Yeah.
They lied to you good.
They said John Girard was a big supporter of the slum clearance. Yeah. Remember John?
Yes, he was, because he had Girard's Electronics, because he also had the TV. He was one that really started community service and TV. He had to, because he was in competition with Jacobs. See, old man Jacobs was the one, Jacobs and Norrell.
Oh yeah,
that was Norrell's son. That's his son. That was his in-law's son-in-law. But Jacobs himself was one. You know, when we hooked on the TV, it cost you $100 at that time. They had a pole up on Fort Hill, and they'd ask, and run the lines from there down to. You paid that $100 up front before you got hooked on.
I remember Isaac Fields told me they got hooked in, and all the kids in the neighborhood
We were lucky to have one of the, we wasn't first, but we were pretty, early. We were one of the earliest ones on the street to get hooked in on the TV. So you can imagine that in the afternoon, we had a room full
of kids. I heard that there is supposed to be low interest, federally insured loans available to homeowners to help you buy replacement housing.
That's exactly right. I know of no one I know a lot of people that put applications in, but for some reason or another, they wouldn't qualify.
Oh, you had to have a certain income?
Yeah, you had to have a certain income. And they really wanted it wouldn't be husband and wife, it would have to be the husband.
Oh, head so of only household. One income could be carried.
Yeah, see, so that killed.
That ruled everybody.
That, sure, well, at the time. Even if you were working on two jobs, that didn't get, you had to make a certain amount on one job. That didn't help at all.
I have yet to run into anybody that ever got one of those low interest loans.
Nobody got one. Nobody that I knew that got one of those loans. I know that even the teachers that applied, they were asked to apply because at the time, the teacher's salary was very low.
They
were strictly 9-month salaries. Because most of the teachers would supplement themselves. They worked part-time jobs on the At the end of the school years, they did have to get other jobs.
Where did the, you know, you talk about like such a tight-knit community of friends and neighbors. After the project started, did these people tend to relocate in one area, or did they just scatter? Or?
No, they scattered. Actually, as I say, the working class opened up. Well, South Frankfort kind of opened up. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of houses, a fairly decent housing that was in South Frankfort that they scattered to. And then, as I say, a lot of them came to the hill, and that opened up, you know, quite a bit.
Have you heard of a Cherokee subdivision?
Yeah, okay, Cherokee.
That was one I've heard mentioned as an area that they were trying to develop.
The Cherokee subdivision. You couldn't. We had bought all this. I wish my aunt had stayed here before you got here. The Swain subdivision is what it was.
What subdivision?
Swain subdivision.
Swain.
The Swains own that.
Where was it?
It's right at the behind the football field. It started there.
You're okay.
Going down Langford.
Yeah.
It went down. Pat Green and his mother owned all the way to the first turn. They owned all that property on that far side. The Swains owned all of it back to where College Park starts.
Okay.
But in other words, Missouri now, as you go down through Missouri, where Tupper is now, that's Missouri and Langford. That's a complete circle.
Yeah, I know exactly.
The Swains own all of it. They sold those lots for $50 a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You couldn't get a contract, you couldn't get anybody to go in that way. I mean, I was a good friend, of the husband. See, the old man died.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lucille is like she was the wife of the son that owned this land. They were living in Detroit.
Swains, right?
Swains.
Yeah.
This is the Swains.
These blacks?
What? These are blacks.
Okay.
Well, they're black. Okay. What happened, and I'll go back to another thing when I get through with the Swain deal. They said, well, we'll just try to sell it off in tracts where the somebody can go and build a home. And they broke it down into these small lots of more or less like what some of the things you had in the bottom. Well, of course, anybody would have to buy two or three of them to build a building.
Yeah.
Okay, but they found out they couldn't get anybody, no contracts to touch it.
Why?
So, for some reason, I don't know why, whether it was blackballed or whatever happened, even the people that owned those. Some people had four or five lots down there.
Could not.
What happened? Ward Oates and Glenn Purdy,
yeah,
and I can't think of the other folks' name. They decided to just start going around and find out who had these deeds. They went out and bought up all that land, and they cleared it straight down off. And they went in there with something that it's a mirage, but of course it was several people that had some fairly good money, like the Turners and a few others. They had built houses. They did. They had actually were able to get houses built before Purdy and them came. And then, after the Purdy and Ward Oates, and I'll come up with the other guy's name because he was used to be vice president of Schindler Distillery, the other fellow that was in on that deal.
Not Liebman, was it?
No, Liebman wasn't out on this. They bought up all these other companies, flattened them out. They started building, putting houses up. But the key was, no matter how much money you ever got, still, it's going to take you 30 years to pay those houses off.
30 years.
30 years. No matter if you got rich the next day. You could never pay your house off in 30 years.
You mean the money you got from the sale of your house down in the bottom, or?
Anything you got, whatever they, like they knew exactly how much money you got.
And so they'd adjust the price
according. The price to that.
According.
That's exactly what they did. Everybody that went in there, that was out of that flood area, out of the area, and whatever they got for the property they owned there, it was, that's the way that price was adjusted on that.
You are the only person that ever has told me anything about Cherokee before.
That's right, that's Cherokee. That's Cherokee Park.
And then College Heights.
College Heights was a different story. That was a, that was another deal. Now we go back to South Franklin. When this happened, there was a man that owned what they call the mill, all that St. John's, which is now in the new flood. That's the new flood story.
Yeah.
I happen to have, I own a house down there. I own two houses down there. Now this is, we're going through the same deal. This is going back into, it's gonna be going through the same type thing, because it's not about not living. You got property owners that live in the area, but now the renters, see, I mean, this, you're going to be totally displaced. Holland Hooper, this fellow by the name of Holland Hooper, owned all this land. So he, what he did, he would sell you a lot on credit and make a deal with you. You could buy these prefab houses. These four of those houses down there, pre-cut, prefab. Alexander's was one of the first to buy one of them. And Lewis.
Is that the house that Alex still lives in there?
No, Alex lived at the first house he lived. It came in on a truck. I helped unload that damn thing. On Sunday, we come in on a Sunday morning, and I'll never forget that. Like, he didn't know. He built, see, next to that, then he built the house. He built the one on the corner after that. And of course, his brother-in-law built the house that's next to that. So Alec and some member of his family owned all three of those houses at one time. Right?
Where were these now on?
On St. John's Court.
St. John's Court.
Okay. Then the one that I own was Patton bought. Mm-hmm. Patton. He got bought that land from Holland Hoop, and he built the apartments. And then this little house, and Vernon Lightfoot built one of the pre-cut houses. So he really wasn't misplaced, but he bought this, that little house next to the, on St. John's too.
So some people were making money off of this.
Sure,
whole
they made money off of it. They exploited it.
It's funny, I've heard people, Papa Jazz Barry, in an article in the newspaper, said that white people made money off bottom.
Sure.
And I never really explained that in the article. Yeah. I assume maybe bootlegging or
even
renting.
Even the illegitimate business, the blacks didn't own it. I mean, they were running it for somebody living on Capitol Avenue.
I knew.
You know? See, I mean, it's, they still got you both ways. They were the, you know, they're the backers, they backed you, but, you know, that was a, it's like old man Hayden that had that beer garden, and my father worked for him. He went to prison for it. My father had to go to prison to keep him from going to prison.
Where was the beer garden?
The beer garden was on Clinton Street, right or down, right down from this thing here, going
Sullivan's
on Clinton
Grocery.
On the same side, on the far side of the street, all
on
the way
the
down.
North side, yeah.
Yeah, it was a, that was between Center Street. There was a little street that went in between there called Center, and the beer garden was the next building over. Oh. Yeah.
Well, your dad took a prison rap for this?
Took a prison rap for
whiskey. For running?
Running whiskey for Hayden. Yeah, that's exactly right. He told him, well, I'll take care of your kids and all that. You go on, you take this, let's go. It wasn't, I mean, it was a, like, I don't guess maybe it's 5-6 months or something like that, but he did, you know, he'd bring some groceries and things in there. I could remember that, you know, like I say, my mother was a real proud woman, and because when I, you know, that that was something to, that it was a stigma that you, you still think about it today. You know, it's one of the reasons I think I maybe I was at a time real bitter.
Yes.
I had a lot of reasons to be bitter.
Well, and I've run into people who are bitter because they feel like they lost a sense of community.
Yeah,
you did. Ms. Gill said, I'm just one black woman stuck out here all by myself.
Right. Now, that's what happened. You know, you could get together within three blocks, walking distance. You didn't have to have a car to communicate with all your friends. Now you got to have a car. You got some stuck over here, some stuck here, and some stuck there. You got to have transportation. Now think of the people that don't drive, and you got to get a, you got a cab. She's one of them. She's got to depend on somebody else to go anywhere she wants to go. So it separated, and it created a caste system too.
How so?
It creates a caste system because, see, if you got over, and then a guy, you know, the chest sticks out, and, you know, they say, well, hell, I don't, you know, I've done, I've made it, you know. All right, well, people will turn against you, you know, in a sense, because you say, well, this person can't, people should never forget from whence they came. And it's, but yet at the same time, it's so much envy, you know.
So that those that succeeded economically,
that's right. They
sort of were looked.
They actually, you know, they are looked down on instead of, you know, glorified. They are looked down on it. It made it's like one of the things I tell you when I this is a heck of a thing to think about. I've always said that the slum clearance caused more marriages because, see, when you go into these housing, you had to, all the common laws, people have been living common law life for all those years, then they made a stipulation that they had to be married to move into the projects.
Oh,
so. And so that, I say that was one good thing. Religiously, that happened, that maybe it was a blessing, you know.
That's the first time I heard of this.
See?
Oh. Well, what happened to the black-owned businesses?
They all disappeared. They couldn't find suitable. They couldn't find a suitable locations, or they couldn't afford the locations, or they'd have found them, because they didn't always say, well, you know, everybody had the same stigma that it's going to create another slum where, you know, if they open up a place here, it's going to, the rowdiness, they didn't want you in South Franklin, they didn't want you on the hill and the businesses. We had just started in 59, the VFW started and, you know, was formed in 59. And then after we moved out of 62, after 62 flood, we didn't go back into that building, we went to up on East Main.
Yeah.
We don't know where we are now.
What happened to Ewan Atkins and Dr. Holmes?
Ewan Atkins was not able to relocate. He didn't own the building. John Buckner owned that building. Yeah. So as I say, when he sold it, see, he displaced that business. When John Buckner sold, he was not able to go back into the building. And it, as I say, he lived, he always roomed with Miss Holmes, who was a teacher at Mayo Underwood. She moved out, she went to out to on Wallace Avenue.
Okay.
Now, see, that was four houses that opened up out there that, you know, blacks had not lived. We was only two black families that lived out there at the beginning. But that wound up being five families out there.
Across the post office and the back in there.
Back in the, Wallace Avenue is out, going out Home Street, and it turns off of Home Street where you know, going back toward the hill again.
Yeah,
that's Wallace Avenue. And because Ms. Holmes was able to find a house out there, she bought. and had to do a tremendous amount of work on her because she had three roomers. And then she had this big two-story house on Clinton, and then she had to build this little thing out there. It was just about less than half the size of what she had moved out of. Plus, you know, I mean, I knew personally by talking to her. I used to drive her. My wife used to drive her around there. She had bought a car, but she couldn't drive. So we used to drive, and I remember she would discuss her business openly, and she was really upset about what they had promised her for the house, and then what they paid her for the house.
She got a lot less than what.
A lot less than what the they.
Did a lot of those folk have to, the own their own homes, have to go back into debt?
Sure, they had to go back into debt. That's what I'm saying. That was the bad part. At that age, you know, to have to go back into debt, because she was nearing retirement age at that time, even. So,
one Mayo Underwood closed, did the black teachers get?
Didn't have three teachers. They didn't get teaching jobs. One of them got a library job, and one of them was later. That they got Miss Alice Samuels was the Miss Alice.
It's rare to find someone like you that not only remembers it but remembers it so vividly.
Oh, yeah.
Miss Gill said, "You know, I remember some of it, but she had been sick and her memory was not quite as good as she would like." Let me get away from urban renewal for a second and get back to some of the businesses that you remember. Tell me about the Sudsateria, where it was and what kind of business it was.
Okay, the Sudsateria was a laundromat. It was a laundromat, and it believe it or not, that was another John Buckley. He owned that building. He owned the building. And at one time, it was a doctor's office up above, a black doctor that had it.
Dr. Holmes was.
No, this is Dr. Gay. He was a dentist. He had an office over there.
Where was Sudsateria?
Sudsateria was in the middle of the block between Washington Street going toward the back of the Capitol.
Okay.
With Madison Street was the next little street there. The Sudsateria was, like I said, they had a little, probably it was only laundromat that the blacks could go to.
It was a black-owned business?
It was not, no. There was a Harrod. Harrod rented that to, you know, put the laundromat in there for, I think it was, the same fellow that had that owned the Pete's Corner.
Not Bob Harrod.
Not Bob Harrod, no. This was another Harrod.
That's funny, because Pete's Corner is sort of the white counterpart to Tiger Inn.
Right. Well, of course, Charles Fields worked for Pete's Corner. We had three black guys that worked for him, and still, Blue Bonnet, the connections are still there. It's the same thing. He works for me today, and I guess Charles is probably 74, 75 years old.
So the same people that own Pete's Corner own Blue Bonnet and Charles still still work.
Right. Well,
I want to go talk to Charles sometime. What about the 99 Club?
Well, the 99 was really long. The 99 came into that with George Taylor. George Taylor bought those two buildings. He bought and had a little restaurant there. A new bear run one of them. And a fellow by the name of Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, he and his wife had come from here, and George Taylor more or less had him as running the bear's business, the Hamburger Johnson.
Where were the two buildings located? Were they on Washington?
They're still on Washington. They were in the same area. This was used to be known as Mike Deacon, which was the basic store. And they made a pool room out of one side.
Was that Knott's
Pool? Knott's Pool Room. Knott's Pool Room. Well, see, Jeff and Knott's worked for George Taylor. All of these were George Taylor Enterprises.
All
these, the three things, he had the three businesses there right there together. three businesses. All of them were owned and operated, but they were operated by Jeff and Bob Knox.
Do you remember an individual referred to as Black Cat?
Black Cat is my father.
Oh, wow. I don't know anything about him other
Black
than
Cat
he's supposed
father.
To be a man who...
If his main thing was if they'd taken black baseball players during that time, he would have been one of them. I mean, if he'd have gone to major leagues, he was that good a pitcher.
Okay. So he played for like Mayo Underwood?
No, he didn't play for Mayo Underwood. He played for these, what they call industrial ball leagues, so black, they call them the Negro leagues. And they, you know, that was one of the hustles that they had. Then they'd go to the various towns, Springfield, Bardstown, and Lebanon, and Versailles, and Lexington, and play ball on Sundays, usually. And they had the old Mayor Lot out there. It's what they call their home field, where they used to have circuses out there on Home Street. That was called Mayor's Lot, where they had their circus, and that's where they had them.
Where on Holmes is that now?
It was, you know where, you know where the surplus property is?
Yeah.
Right across from the street, going toward the hill.
Yeah.
That lot back then, that was called Mayor's Lot. That was the ball. They had a regular stadium field, you know, out there. That's
what team did your dad play for?
Well, it was
a bunch of teams?
They called them the Merchants. It's the Merchants, the Franklin Merchants. Because, like I say, they was a big time deal then. I mean, people would turn out like you'd bag, you know.
Black and white?
Right, black and white would follow them. You know, they'd play the guys like old man John Follis, and like he'd like to bet on them, you know. They'd bet that money, and because they bootleg good too out of the ball games.
When was he playing? Balls. When was your dad playing? About what time?
Well, see, he played from all the way through the. He even played up and into the 40s. Up into the 40s.
When do you know when he started playing? Probably 1900.
I don't know. See, he got out of service. He was in World War I, too. And I guess after he got out of service, that's when they started playing ball.
But he didn't, like you say, he didn't make his living playing ball.
No, he wasn't no. But of course, like I say, they made. It wasn't. They got paid, you know. They got paid. Everybody like sometimes. But what would happen? They'd say, "Winner take all." Winner, they'd take the gate, you know, because the guys renting, they charge so much on the game. That's like 50 cents or 25 cents, something like that. But they, and also they. Bet among the sales, you know, that they're going to win. But like I say, that would be a lot of money. And when they won, we'd always have more to eat. I know that, you know. I can remember that. It was a lot more food.
Yeah. Well, they say your dad was sort of the black John Follis of
Bob. Well, that's what it was. They respected him. At least one thing, you know, like I say, he was a law and order man, you know, as far as somebody got in trouble or whatever it is, he could kind of straighten them out, and that's what, I guess he's sort of like the mediator for trouble.
I see.
That was the one thing he could do, you know.
So if you got in a fix, you could come to your dad,
and
he might square it with the right people?
He'd square it with the police or with the judge or something. They respected him that way, if he told them something was right. You know, like I say, he was a peacemaker, it's supposed to be, I guess.
I see.
More like a peacemaker.
When you think of some of the places down there, the joints, the Blue Moon, the Tiptoe, Peachtree, are those places that blacks went to? Or?
No, the blacks didn't go in them. You know, they didn't go in them, but like Yellex Gardens, Peachtree, and it's like I say, the crowds, each man respected his own territory. Now you had some whites that could come in to all the black joints, and be welcome as let's go. But most of the blacks just wouldn't go into these other jobs.
What were the black joints? Where would you go as a black?
Well, you had, I was just thinking. These are all black joints in that area. All of these was in that place.
Where was Shine Boy?
Shine Boy was on the corner across from school. Shine Boys was where the school kids in the day, you know, they sold hot dogs and chili and bean soup. And he's like the Tiger and they had about the same.
This is not a drinking place, this is just an eating place.
No, they
place.
Was eating, but in the night, no, they would drink. I mean, they sold beer. He sold beer at the school house.
Oh, I see.
And he had a little dancing place in the back.
Who was Shine Boy?
Shine Boy was some regular guy. He was a character. He came out of Holland.
Harlan?
He came out of Holland, yeah.
Eastern Kentucky. What was his name?
You know what, I can't think of what his real name was because he's dead now. And he just died, I'm talking about the last 5 or 6 years. But I mean, he drove a cab in Cincinnati, even in later years after he left there. He was a World War I veteran.
Mm-hmm.
I run into him at the hospital in Dayton, Ohio, at the VA hospital one time. I run into him after he left here. He'd been gone out of Frankfort for, I couldn't tell you, maybe 35 years or maybe. You know, but the renewal got him too, you know.
Yeah.
And he had three black barbershops.
Shine Boy did?
No. He wound up one time, he did have two restaurants at the same time. Yeah. He had the restaurant up under the American Legion, which is,
what was the name of that place?
Civil Slipper. Called it the Silver Slipper.
Silver Slipper, yeah. Okay. Would this have been in the 50s or?
This would have been in the 50s, yeah. It would have been the 50s, the early 50s. The early 50s.
Who were the three barbers, the black barbers?
You had Bob Martin, you had John Davis, and then of course you had Mr. Fred Allen, and Wesley Martin's father. And it was the other fellow, you know, we called him Corn Pudding. His name was Charles Childs. Charles Childs was his real name.
Little Rose or little what's that one there?
Little Reston, they called it. That was the George Taylor's too. George Taylor ran that. Newt Berry ran the Little Reston, what they called it.
Where was Ike's?
Grill, Ike's was other side of the grill. The grill was two places. See, two restaurants in one. Swain's own, the same Swain's I'm talking about, they were the ones that built. They built this. He was a brick mason.
Okay.
He built these two buildings.
The grill
and what we could wind up in, which was Will Wren's first.
Okay.
Now, when they told them the partition between the two buildings, and they just made it the grill,
mm-hmm.
And because there was still Swain's, they had an apartment up on the top of the building, and on both of them they had apartments on top of both of these buildings here, but they were right side by side. And the next was American Legion, and then of course 99 was on the other side of the street. The white spot was belonged to Buckner too.
Okay.
And it was on Clinton Street. It was on Clinton. There was a church on the corner, Bethel Church. Next to that was the Gaines's. Next to that was Henrietta Gill. Next to the Sud, that was none of the Sud's interior, and next to that was the White Spot.
Was the White Spot sort of
it was a restaurant and beer joint. And because you had a little dance space in the back of it. And it ran all the way back to the half of Wisconsin. And all the buildings behind that, next to that is where Tubby Marshall lived.
He was supposed to be a famous, pretty famous athlete, wasn't he, Tubby Marshall?
Yeah. Well, Tubby was a Eglin, and he was an Eglin official. The daddy was a, you know, he all the college football games. He was a porter. He was a cook on the railroad of L&E. Uh-huh. And but on the weekend, he always could arrange on these Saturdays to officiate ball games. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And he ran for city commissioner. And he was the first black to run for city commissioner.
When did he do that?
That
do you
was,
remember?
Yeah, that was right after. It was in the 60s. He did that.
Tubby Marshall?
Tubby Marshall. Ellsworth Marshall Sr.
Oh, so I talked to his son. That's
it. Talked to his son. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He's three Ellsworth Marshalls. Ellsworth Marshall Jr. and Ellsworth Marshall III.
Oh,
man, this
is great. I'm learning some great stuff.
Yeah.
The beer garden was on Clinton?
The beer garden was where I was telling you that the beer garden was down.
Down the street. Sullivan's.
It was from Sullivan's. You got on across the alley, it was those five houses, the Fencil's Meat Market, and then across the street and there was one house and then the beer garden, which that was Hayden's. That's where my father had long ago before and went early, because my father ran the beer garden too, for Hayden.
Were most of these places in operation at the time of urban renewal?
They were all in operation. Every one of them was in operation.
Did any one of them survive?
None of them, but the American Legion went to Lexicon. American Legion was not a person that came out of one barbershop survived. John Davis came to up on East Main.
I see his. Right, yeah.
That's where his tail is now. But that's where he was. Because Dr. Holmes owned that building. The. None of the rest of them.
None of them made it.
None of them.
Just
the American Legion and the VFW are the only two that made it. And that one barbershop after the urban renewal.
So it sort of decimated the black business community.
It did that. It definitely did.
This was great. This is the first time I heard of many of these places. Yeah. Thank you very much for going to that trouble. When you think of the leaders, the people who were respected in the black community, the people that you turn to, who comes to mind?
Well, you know, would have been Jackson Robb. But see, Jack never wanted to take that type of responsibility from a standpoint that in his business and the dealing at the time, Jack made a tremendous amount of money as an entertainer.
I heard he had a trio.
Yeah, he had a trio, and he had but he played the solo piano and the organ in all the white places, you know, that where there's sometimes just one main entertainment, Capitol Hotel. He was just accepted, probably. So, I guess probably that he didn't like to rock the boat. So, we were looking to John Buckner because of property. But at the same time, circumstances were showing you that John Buckner was more or less John Buckner.
Yes.
I was a rebel. I was a rebel. Then Earl Tracy. It was the same way. He had, Earl had a lot of, he came from the same mold. He was from working with the hats.
Okay.
He worked with the hats. He learned a little refrigeration and he delivered ice cream and all of that. And he bought a lot of property. He was able to save enough money. He was a pretty good businessman as far as property, buying property. And then,
what about Will Castleman? That's a name.
Will Castleman was like my father, but he was in a different mold. And he was a strong armed man. That George Taylor first turned his business as far as the black business dealing with all the blacks. Yeah. And so he's the one that did.
Will did that for him.
Yeah, he did that.
I heard Will was sort of a fixer. You get into a scrape, you go to Will, and he could kind of square it.
He'd call Jerry Jefferson, some of the others.
I heard that.
L. Boone Hampton.
Who was that?
L. Boone Hampton.
L. Boone Hampton.
His son is Johnny Hampton down there.
Mr. Hampton was a power.
He's a power.
Did they work the polls?
They worked the polls. They tell you who to vote for and bring the tickets, bring the ballots. See, at the time you had the ballots, so you get the one, they start off with that one ballot and they fix them up themselves.
Oh, they
got $2 and a half pint of whiskey.
$2 and a half pint of whiskey for your vote.
That's your vote. And they, you know, they go to your house, bring it to your house and go to your house.
I mean, they bring the ballot out and they give you your money and your whiskey and you'd sign off and they'd take it home?
Take it, you just switched it around and you go in and you bring that one out and you get another one. You know, you brought the one out and you get two.
I've heard that said that the bottom was a politically powerful, had to go down to the bottom if you wanted.
You had to get win, you know, because you get, like I say, the people, they voted, you know, they were almost forced to vote. You know, whether you wanted to vote or not, it was just one of those. That was the one. They knew that they had the wards. So you had wards in there, and that, so you had to have that. Well, you couldn't win an election without the ballot. You know, you had guys, people didn't have even houses. They living on the street and living in boxes and things of this type. But they could vote. They know how to go to the polls and go and get that ticket.
One of Ms. Gill's theories is that one of the reasons urban renewal came down there is to break up that black vote.
Sure, it was. It's a very good possibility that when you're saying that in that one area that you're talking about, it would be anywhere from 700 or 800 votes, and you know. A councilman could win with 1,300. Just 1,300. At that time, you could win 1,300 to 1,400 votes.
So I imagine you all saw people like Frank Sauer coming down there, and Paul Judd.
Paul Judd was Paul was a type of aristocratic type dude. He would send somebody else
to come down.
Yeah, see, he would basically wouldn't come down.
Yeah.
Because see what would happen. Another thing, I was going to say that you had guys like Pally Thomas, and which was some Kentian writer. And he had another guy was Thomas that's wife still lives over on South Franklin. He was a trash man. He had a trash business. He picked up all the
garbage.
All the garbage and trash out of all the business places. And what would happen during election time, they'd have a big rally in his yard. He had a backyard that ran out into St. John's, because they'd bring the beer and the whiskey, you know, and the beautiful politician would come. And they'd speak to you on
court you. At least for one or two days.
Yeah, that one day, you know, give you some hot dogs and a bottle, you know, they'd have a couple of pills of whiskey there. And that was just a going thing on an election day. You know that was gonna happen, you know. That was the kind of politics that they did.
When you think back on everything that's happened, the Capitol Plaza project and all that, was it a good or bad thing that Bottom is gone?
Well, it's you can't have it both ways. I know that. You can't have it both ways. I feel that in some ways probably that it was. The adversity was an incentive to do better.
It actually spurred some people.
It spurred some people to try to defeat that what was happening. And I feel like that's one of the things that happened to me. I believe, you know, that was one of the blessings of it. But the way in which it was done was definitely wrong. It was definitely wrong. It was a master plan to disband majority of the blacks in that community.
It's funny, what you just said is almost the same thing that James Papa Jazz Barry said. He said, I came out of it economically better, and I doubt that I would go back if such a place existed again.
Yeah.
But he missed, there was something about it that he missed. And that's
Well, that's sort of basically what I think, and I actually believe that. And as you say, you know, that it was a total mirage. They came in and painted it such a beautiful picture, you know, as how things are going to be so much better. But it was people that suffered 15, 20 years.
As a result
of it, actually. It broke up families. People were taking sides. The black leadership, it was totally disrupted. You know, because it's just like, you take what we wound up with in the American Legion over there. You had a building that was made, that was put together by blacks. I mean, that was built. That's a three-story building. And you wind up with a little hut compared to what you had. They owned that building. They built it. That building was built by black craftsmen and black organizations. They actually got, that was Oddfellas went in there. And
was this the one at the corner?
Clinton and Washington. The white three-story Pearson Creek stone.
Yeah.
A beautiful building. Three stories. It was had two businesses in the bottom, and then had the American Legion was running their business, and then they had living quarters on one side, and then they had a dance floor and a lodge. The Masonic Lodge met up there for years and years on the third floor. They were also running. You know. I mean, it was a nice, huge size building. And when you find out what they gave for that, just like I say, they condemned the building.
Oh, okay.
The guys, you couldn't get your money. Now, you couldn't say the building was dilapidated because everything was up to snuff.
Yeah, what could they base a condemnation on?
Right, that's exactly right. But they were not going to let it just stand there by itself. Now, we argued with them. We argued several times. I mean, but they said they going to reconstruct it, and they said no, that building can't stay there, you know, what we going to put in here.
That was one of the, I won't say it's a lie, but at one point one of the leaders of the urban renewal said if a house is in good condition on a good lot, it could stay.
Yeah, exactly right.
And not a single one
building
stayed.
Not a building down there stayed. You sat down there because they couldn't say that that church was out of Corinthian was a beautiful church, well kept, maintained inside and out, and it didn't stay.
Fortunately, they did get the build and a new location, though they lost their pipe organ.
They lost the pipe organ, they went into a tremendous amount of debt.
Yeah.
You see, you gave up a big building with all that space and all the things. They had a in the back of that, I went to Sunday school there. That, all of the fellowship hall that they had in the back of that, it was beautiful.
Describe it to me if you.
The behind the left of the building, they built which ran into the back of that building, ran into my backyard, which I could look right through the backyard the way it was situated. And they got together back then and built this, what they call a fellowship hall, which it was, they had Sunday school classes on the top floor. Mm-hmm. Then they had another big, what they call Sunday school room, where they could have a banquet and they had food. They had a kitchen, a full-fledged kitchen. Yeah. And it was a heck of a thing.
Sounds almost like a community
and
center.
It had offices, right. It was like, and that's what we used it for. We used it as a community center. It was one of the originals of community centers. And then when they took that, you know, it was no comparison to what they have over there. It's no comparison.
I've sort of taken up a lot of your time.
But you
have given me more in the last hour and a half than almost anybody I've talked to. Yeah. And I always leave, I've talked to about half a dozen to 10 people now, and I always leave wondering if I ask the right questions. Was there any question you expected me to ask that I didn't, or something that you wanted to say when I first called you and that you hadn't got a chance to say?
No, I mean, I was trying to, I've been going over a few things in my mind that I didn't, you know, and I had no idea what questions you were going to ask.
I thought about writing them out and sending them, but I got to thinking that maybe there'd be other things you'd want to talk about, and if I gave you a list of questions, you'd feel like, well, I shouldn't talk about these.
No, it's I'm open. The adversities I can handle those. As I said, it's a strange thing, and I talk about it a lot now. In some ways, we had better relationships during those times than I think we'll ever have.
You mean white, black?
White and black. That's right.
Because you both suffered adversity?
We were both suffering adversities. But in some ways, it's like, it's guys that I know down there. And I like to tell the stories about one particular guy. We used to fight every day, but we would let nobody else fight. You see? I mean, we fight over models, fight over something, but nobody, no other white guy better not jump in here, or no black guy jump in here. Yes, you know, that was one of those things. This guy who got killed, his name was Buncombe Killiam. And he was a bottom rat. He was totally a bottom rat. He was a nephew of one of the guys who used to be a fire chief over in the Franklin, the fire chief.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to talk to one of the firemen. Guy came up to me at the Senior Citizen Center and said he wanted to talk to me. He worked with Bixie Falls. I cannot think of his name.
Well, I was sorry. You know, now, like I said, I had a lot of... You'll probably hear about a guy named Artis Choir. And we... some of the Brookses. R.T. Brooks.
I talked to R.T.
R.T. Brooks. We see Opal Brooks. Rebel. His name was True. She married a guy named True. But, I mean, all during those early years... we played ball right behind the house on the sandbar, we called it. So
yeah.
When the city was, they were courting us to the point where they put lights up down there where we could play at night. You know, that was to keep us from trying to play over on Second Street. That was all.
So they put lights up at the sandbar?
Put lights on the sandbar. They did. And finally, that was a city commissioner.
Back in the 40s or something?
Back in the 40s. They put that... But this was in 46, and 46 when we got out of service. They didn't put the lights up over there.
Isaac Fields told me a story. He said as a kid, when the water came up, they see used to have a dump down by the river.
Right, exactly.
They get big sticks and they wait for the rats
and
to come out.
They'd kill them rats, man. They'd come run out of there like, see, the right next to the ball field was the dump.
Yeah.
And then had a little lighthouse there, you know. And them rats, I'm talking about big rats.
The
cats. Cats have rats. You'd have to wall good, go to wall good. In fact, they take baseball bats, probably have to kill them bad boys. But when they'd start up, just through the water start up. That's a final recreation for us, to go down and kill something on you. And see, a lot of times, they'd take rocks, and them rats would get up on the wood, and it'd be floating around in that air, and because you'd try to knock them off in that. but we did all that kind of stuff.
Well, thank you so much. I tell you what, when I get done with this thing, I'm going to try to write up a paper on it. And I'm going to turn these tapes over to, you know where the Library and Archives building is? They have the research room back in there, and they have a collection of oral history tapes. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to turn the tapes over there so they'll be kept for, so many times a guy does a project, he keeps it at his home, nobody ever gets to use it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to turn it over to the Oral History Commission, let them keep the tapes, and I'll send you, I finished a first draft on my urban renewal paper. I'll send you that so you can see, and if you see anything wrong in there, I tried to make 2 points in there. The mirage point that you made, and the fact that Bottom wasn't just an area of slums or poor people. There, it was all kinds of people and good houses.
Very good housing.
And so, when you take a look at this, and you tell me if you think I did justice.
Mm-hmm.
But Thanks. I mean, I've taken more of your time than anybody else, but you had more stories than anybody else.
Well, I'm glad I could help you out.
You've been a great help. Great help.
That's, hopefully, that maybe I can come up with some more pictures in detail where these streets actually, you notice, here's what something they put up. You see these, the concrete thing, they had the names on.
Yeah,
they put them
up, posts there.
They put those in up, and I guarantee it was be 1940. It was probably 1945, 46 when we got back. They were new then. And on every street, they had that. And I've got pictures, you know what I'm saying? Some of them we have come up with that'll have the street, you know, the streets. On those particular things, even right down in the bottom, I had the Washington Street.
That would be great because I could
Vero
identify
and,
a building.
Yeah, see, then
if I get it set up at my end with the photographer, yeah, we'll probably have a couple of days where you can bring your photos by, get them copied, and take the originals home.
Yeah, well, I'd like to do that. I don't know why I didn't think about it. I got a big album of that, and some of the things that we were able to save. Where I lived and in front of my house and inside the house, you know, to see what kind of conditions
we were. Oh, that would be wonderful. I'll get back to you later in the summer on that. But thanks again. I appreciate it.